And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is Friday, April 12th. Derek Van Riperino, Sarah, Trevor May, all here with you. It's been a fun week in baseball. Tons of things happening, including more details. More fun details. including a criminal complaint against Ipe Mizuhara, former translator for Shohei Ohtani. We're going to talk about some early adjustments that players have to make during the season. And we're going to dig into a ridiculous home run that Trevor gave up that actually connects to a few other ideas we had when putting the show together. Talk about some early adjustments, when to worry, when to believe. And then we're going to dig into a new segment, how to pitch to this guy. We're going to focus on Mookie Betts. It should be easy, right? Finding a game plan that works against Mookie Betts. I mean, no one's really ever done it successfully before, so why can't we figure it out?
Trevor has.
I have figured it out. I was going to hold on to that until later in the show, but technically, not a huge sample size, but...
Hey, winning the battle counts, right?
Yeah.
Got to keep score somehow. If you're not in the Discord, you can join that. Got a link in the show description. Be sure to jump on in there. I wanted to ask you guys, and now that there's more information, a lot more information about the story than we had even on the Thursday episode, were there any things that just jumped off the page looking at that 37-page criminal complaint against Ipe Mizuhara, things that just sort of blew your mind, and either simplicity of how he did what he did, or any other details that you're just like, wait, that's how that went down?
I feel like people failed him. You know, people in Ohtani's inner circle failed him. And, you know, Craig Calcaterra said that, you know, obliviousness is not a crime. So, you know, maybe just Ohtani was oblivious to this, but, you know, he trusted people in his inner circle. He trusted the angels, and the angels said, oh, Ipe called you and said he was the interpreter for Okajima and he wants to be your interpreter. Yeah, sure. You know, like, they didn't do a background check. They didn't even call the Red Sox and be like, hey, was this guy actually, because the Red Sox recently came out and were like, nope. It was never worked for us, you know. Apparently, at some point, the financial advisors were like, hey, we need to get into that account. Like, why is there an account that we can't see into? And Ipe's like, it's private. And they were like, okay. Like, you're just like, oh man, like, how did that's sort of part of this is the failure of his inner circle. Like, he should fire some people, I think.
Yes, he should definitely fire some people. It turns out that Ipe was the only one who spoke Japanese and English. So it's just one of those situations where he's like, I can say whatever I want both ways and just keep control of the situation. And, you know, that said, like, it's one of those weird things. I try to give people the benefit of the doubt as much as possible, like, how things can snowball. You do something that you're not very proud of, and then you lie once, and then before you know it, you know, 6 months have passed, and you had 19 opportunities to tell the truth and then you didn't. And then things are much worse than they were. It literally feels like reading this, that it's like going to be turned into a screenplay like the next season of Fargo. It's one of those like crazy situations, like, you know, the only thing that was missing, and thank God this never happened, but like a hostage situation happened. And then we're like, why did he get taken by a bookie or something? And we're like, that's when it becomes Fargo. So fortunately we didn't get to that point, but like, this is how that show starts. Of anyone who's seen it, it's pretty crazy. So I was just like, this is bizarre. The amounts of money being like casually mentioned by both the bookmaker and Ipe, just like they're having these like normal chats about, oh yeah, sorry, I'm late on that, you know, $10 million payment. And he's like, you know what, don't worry about it. We'll work worried out on business hours on Monday. Like, I'm like, this isn't, I've seen The Sopranos. This isn't how this is supposed to go. That doesn't make any sense.
When does the knee breaking come in?
Yeah, jeez.
You start to wonder, because there's one detail in here about November 17th, 2023. Bookmaker 1 messaged Mizuhara stating, Hey, Ippy, it's 2 o'clock on Friday. I don't know why you're not returning my calls. I'm here in Newport Beach and I see Victim A, that's Otani, walking his dog, that's Decoy. I'm just going to go up and talk to him and ask how I can get in touch with you since you're not responding. Please call me back immediately. It does feel like we were reaching a point in the last 6 months where things were getting even more out of hand. Like, the way you were alluding to, Trevor, like that, that's a bad situation through and through.
Yeah, that sounds threatening from a, at least, like, I'm going to tell him.
Right. You know, situation. At a minimum, yeah. It's that.
At a minimum. And, you know, but we're talking about amounts of money that are kind of unfathomable to anybody doing illegal bookmaking. I haven't seen that those numbers thrown around in a movie. Like, it's bigger numbers than I've ever seen.
He lost $180 million and won $140 million. So he owed $40 million. I mean, we thought it was $4.5 million where he kept giving him five. He basically kept him away by giving him $500,000 payments from the big nut that he still owed him. Like, apparently still owes him like $30 million. Like, it's, that's crazy.
And you know, you're not collecting that. So it's astronomical. What was the average? It was like average of two. The average bet was $12,800.
Yeah, it was a five-figure average bet, but the range was down as low as $10. I thought that was a typo in the report. I'm like, wait, when were you firing off $10 bets and why?
The number of transactions and bets that were happening, it feels like he was like almost honestly like doing betting as like a day trading situation. That's what it feels like. There was dozens of them a day. Like, he was at his computer watching charts and setting up like bots.
But he wasn't, though. Like, I think he's just a full-on addict. He thought he had like an idea, but he obviously had no idea.
But I don't know how you have the time. Like, I don't, is he just staying up all night and doing the, you know? Or is he just like picking them? I bet it's just picking them. Just dartboarding it, which is even just, I don't know.
I know, right? Like, imagine how insane the conversation would be where he's like, you know what? I feel good about the Eagles. Put me $100,000 on the Eagles. Oh, but you know, how about a $10 four-team parlay?
I'm feeling good about that
on
one.
The NBA.
I like UCLA soccer today against Utah. Like that, what?
Yeah, right. It's even all the way down there.
It's weird, man. It's super weird. So yeah, tons of surprises. It's out there. You should read it. It's 37 pages, but the spacing of the legal document is such that it's kind of the way when you were in fourth or fifth grade and didn't want to write a paper, or maybe when you're in college, you know, double spacing, skinny margins. It's not 37 pages. It's like 8 to 10 actual pages to read. So it's not that hard to get through it. Fascinating stuff. And I think there's a movie. There's more of a book movie feel to this than I ever thought, now that we've got more details. But let's move on to actual baseball, because that's where Shohei seems to be at this point. Baseball's hard, and the difficulty of making early adjustments is on full display. We had one of our users in Discord asking about a problem that Henry Davis is having with high fastballs in particular. And this is pretty interesting stuff. I put together a little montage here. Grayson Rodriguez is going to get him twice. This is in the same matchup. Dean Kramer gets him. Casey Mize is going to get him next series. And it's like a pretty clear pattern. Like, those are good fastballs, 95, 97, up in the zone or above the zone. But clearly there's a book, right? We're seeing teams give Henry Davis more fastballs, up over 60% fastball usage against him to begin the season. So you start to look at it and say, okay, what's the drawback of Davis possibly adjusting or overcorrecting trying to hit the high fastball? If he fixes that, does that leave him vulnerable to something else in the zone? Like, because it's always a game of cat and mouse, right? You've got something that's working right now, and pitchers are probably going to lean on that until it stops working.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw that with J.J. Bleday. He had a hole at the top of the zone, and this year he's making 100% contact across the top of the zone. And just really weirdly, because he's a low ball hitter, there are now blue spots in the bottom of the zone. The way I kind of think about it, something I've asked hitters is like, do you have one swing or do you have like five swings? People have different answers. They want to tell me they have one swing because they're a hitter. They just want to be like, I have one swing. But the way I kind of understand it a little bit is A swing, B swing, C swing. And you have a swing where you're fighting off something. You're just trying to do enough so that they make a mistake and go to your happy zone. I would assume that Blade's A swing is still low in the zone. He's being pitched high in the zone, and he's doing his B or C swing to fight those off. The relative quality of that B or C swing is going to determine whether or not they actually go back down low in the zone, and he can actually get his A swing off. Then there also has to be a timing and anticipation component where you're like, I am ready to do my A swing on this one. You know, so you kind of want to anticipate what's going to happen on this pitch so that you get ready to do it. And I think what we're seeing with Cody Bellinger is he's kind of settled in. He used to have A and B and C, and he's kind of settled in. And he's just like, I'm kind of going to do my B most of the time, especially with two strikes. I'm doing my B swing. I'm just going to always do my B swing. And that's what you get is my A swing until there's two strikes and then my B swing. And that's going to be a really simple plan I can do. I think what you see with Henry Davis, and if you look at the second montage, is he's developing a bit of a B swing that he can handle high heat. But this is what happens. He's fouling off half of the 51 pitches. Yeah, what would a foul ball look like anyway? You see him fighting a foul ball off to the other way. Half of his 51 pitches in the top 2-3. So what he's just trying to do is muscle those pitches away. He hasn't been able to sort of turn them straight, get them into play. And a pitcher will take a foul ball, you know. So if you're trying to pump high fastballs to a hitter and the best he can do is foul it off, like that. Yeah, that's a typical one from him. Like Trevor, you're cool with that, right? If he's like, it's a whiff or a foul.
It's a whiff or a foul, yeah. But like there is a big difference in my head and most hitters' heads about difference between foul and whiff, because whiff is a strikeout and foul is the at-bats continuing. And so many guys, especially right on right, and relievers, double especially, is the like get to the breaking ball whenever you can anyway. So their fastballs are show me even if they throw 97. So they're going to throw it again, which this is going to come up when we talk about Mookie here in a minute. I had this conversation with Pete Alonso because he goes off and on with handling high pitches, but generally hands low much better than high. It's not about, I think, especially for a guy like Henry Davis and another guy to check out is DJ Stewart. Like I mentioned that to you guys. So if you want to check his heat maps as well, listeners, he's another guy to watch how he's changed over the last 4 years, because he couldn't hit the fastballs up in the zone at all either. It's changed a little bit, but not a lot. It comes down to not technically, like people tend to think, hey, I'm going to turn this hole into a strength. And that isn't necessarily what you want to do. You just want to extend the bats. I use Miggy Cabrera as my example. He did that better than anyone I ever saw, is extending at bats and being okay with getting a crappy swing off and just like keeping the bat going to get the pitch that he wants. Like a pitch, them to take a chance somewhere where he's going to have closer to where he's going to handle it well. And knowing what that is. And so like your weaknesses are just bat extension areas. And then your strengths are what you're doing your damage on. Ozzie Albies is a great example too. Here's a guy, because I faced him a lot. Up is, he struggles with it, especially from the left side of the plate. I throw him up for the first two strikes, literally like strike one, strike two, fastball by him. And then he just fouled them off after that. Like he wasn't swinging and missing for the third strike there, even though it was a hole. It was just something, but he wasn't hitting it hard either.
He had a B swing. He knew you were going to go up there.
Yeah. But he never even really wanted to put it in play. The ones he did, he just popped it up in the infield. So those ones, I was good, but I was like, you were missing it before. Now you're not missing it at all. And in my mind, I'm like, it's just not a two-strike pitch, even though on the map it says he swings and misses at it constantly overall. And so I knew that, and I had to adjust. And there wasn't as many options with two strikes as there was early. If Henry can do that, where he's like, sure, I'm going to take my A swing, still probably get beat a couple times early in the at-bat, but you can't punch me out on it, that changes the complexion of how you're being approached. You don't even have to ever hit the ball for a hit. You just need to not be so easily gotten out that way. That's all you have to do with your weaknesses.
But that Alonso conversation, there was a little bit of like take versus fight off, right? You were asking him about actually like making contact on some of those pitches and why not take them, right? There was a little bit of that component too.
And that was also like, you know, the high fastball was being trained a lot. This was like 2021. So this is like the big, like everyone's throwing heaters up. That was the sweeper of that year. And umpires were also getting better at calling it versus strike. And not miss. And like now they're kind of not calling the high strike as much, obviously on purpose, because we want the ball lower in the zone with more offense. I understand that. But if you could get those strikes, it was just like it was going to be a strike, full ball in the zone. You have to swing in it. You still can't hit it. That those guys who did that well, like guys like Pete would be like, I can't take him. I can't get the big 3-run homer on that pitch. And if he can sit there, I have to be able to foul it off until eventually he's like, man, I can't get a fastball by him. I have to throw a slider here. And then you got to not miss that. And that's That's what he kind of has thought. And he's gotten better and better and better at it, I think, every year because of just knowing that.
If you're watching Henry Davis, you're saying he's a step ahead of the just take it strategy, right? Because Brandon Moss like had a similar swing where he couldn't get the bat flat and he couldn't handle high and away. And he was telling me, yeah, they're just trying to go there. And I'm just trying to take most of those pitches, you know, and take them for balls. But the next step is, I can at least spoil that.
Figuring out what's probably going to be a strike too. So you're not just taking strikes. Like you're just trying to get the pitcher to be like, huh, maybe that's not as automatic as I thought. If you can get,
maybe I can't punch him out on that.
Exactly. If you can get that thought out of a pitcher's head, like there is no automatic in a situation spot like that. When I saw something, I was like, I am so confident throwing it there. But if that's not quite there, that changes the complexity of things and the type of hitter you are immensely. Even if you statistically you haven't changed a lot on what you're hitting hard, you're just not missing it. It's just not a zero sum as much. So that's, yeah, it's learning the top of the zone though. Taking is a good way to learn where that is. And that he's still, you know, that's probably part of it too, where he doesn't actually know. And by the way, the top of the zone's way lower in the minors right now and has been for 2 years. So it's very confusing. Guys come up and they have no idea where the high strike is. That's why some guys, young guys are struggling a little bit to what to take and what to swing at because it's hard to tell. It really is. It's hard to figure it out. It's hard to figure it out for pitchers and hitters right now in AAA. Like, where is the strike zone? How big is it? That adjustment too, to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's a huge adjustment if the zones are different like that, because Davis was having so much success throughout his time in the minors. I think a lot of people had an expectation he'd hit the ground running in the big leagues. But if this is the hole and that's how the zone works, it sort of highlights a problem that you couldn't even exploit that problem against him in the minors potentially. And the pitching's different, so that's another variable, of course, as well. It's interesting because the how do we know if he's adjusted is going to be something pretty small that you're not necessarily going to see in stats. You're going to see a lot more just by watching him on a day-to-day basis, right? Because it might not be statistical improvement against fastballs per se. It might not be a run of homers off of high fastballs. It might just be surviving on those pitches to get something else that he does damage on. That's the hard part, I think, for people trying to track it and say, should I keep throwing him in my lineup every week? Do I trust him to be a guy that I should go trade for right now in fantasy leagues? Like, those are the questions everyone wrestles with this time of year. Is this real? Is this going to be a problem long term? The adjustments are going to be very subtle.
There's a theme, though, that runs through today's podcast, and this will come up again, is just that be careful of the settings on the heat maps. If you're playing around with heat maps, think about the settings. Think about what you're looking at. Like, you could be looking at WOBA or slugging or called strikes or swinging strikes. Those things all have slightly different meaning. And in this case, you could look at a WOBA heat map and say, man, he's not that good high in the zone. But then if you drill down and you realize, wow, he fouled off half the pitches that are thrown here, like, that can't be as bad as just completely swinging and missing on all these pitches. So, you know, there's this will come up again, but, you know, just to think about like the different things that the pitcher wants to do in certain places and the different things the hitter wants to do and like what you're looking for when you're looking at a heat map. And sometimes it may be as simple as a WOBA because the pitcher thinks, well, he's just not that good up there, so I'll take the foul. But it does matter when they're trying to get to the swing strike, the strikeout. Like, why doesn't Henry Davis, if he has this big hole, why doesn't he have like a 40% strikeout rate? Partially because he's fouling off those pitches and they can't punch him out up there. And he's strong low in the zone. So there may actually still be a foundation for a breakout here.
Yeah, the overall K rate's not through the roof. It's still under 30%. So it's not like he's up there striking out 38% of the time and looks like he's going to get sent back down. It's more like this is the way to pitch to him right now. A little easier to pitch to Henry Davis than it is to pitch to Mookie Betts, as we will get to here in just a couple of minutes. Now, we have a great highlight from Trevor, and I forget how we even stumbled into this. And we're just going to play this first. We'll ask some questions along the way. This is Christian Walker. Look at that pitch. What on earth?
It's better with the hold.
I added a hold.
It was better with the hold.
I added the hold because you described this play to us perfectly. You described exactly where you threw it, how hard you threw it, what Walker did do it, and your reaction to it. Everybody had a reaction of, whoa, what just happened there? Because that's not supposed to happen on a high inside fastball like that. And pitches like that and homers like that make me think, yeah, you know what? If I was trying to be a major league pitcher, I would gamble on my own health trying to throw the filthiest, hardest stuff possible, because pitches like that can be hit out for homers.
Yeah, that is honestly one of the harder ones where it's a straight up, straightforward tip of the cap. Like he's like, I don't know how I did that. And you're like, I don't know how you did that. And then, you know, he just won. And that's it. And I was hot. I came up, I think, because I was talking about how Scherzer was just like, just don't throw that.
Yeah, because it was only 90 miles an hour. It was like 90.
It was 92.6. Yeah, 92.6 off the. So we've been taught. And at this time it's 21. So like we're like, are the balls still juiced? Do we know? Like that was a conversation that was happening a lot, because some stuff like that was happening. You're like, come on. And obviously the narrative was like, no, we're not changing them. So like that was the flavor of the week. So like I think that's why I was hot. But also how I prepare for guys, I know like he's got a spot that's just ice cold right there. Right. Like, and he knows it. Like, I think he's just fouling stuff off up there. But I think eventually he's like, he's going to come up and in this time, and I'm just going to sell out. And he still got jammed. And he like looked like where to go. And I flipped around, like tried to catch it too. And it just got
definitely
out. Real
foul,
fast.
Right? You were like, it's foul ball.
Foul,
right?
Foul. I thought it was like way foul. I thought it was like a jam shot, like off the net. And it was like, just stayed fair. I was like, this is just, he's so strong. Like, he's like one of the few guys who could do that. There's also when he's rounding first, he's hot, he's so pumped because he's like, that was really like, I don't know how that happened. I'm pumped though, because I'd been just wearing him out there. I've been wearing him out there as well, like every time we'd face each other. And he just, he'd fouled off, but he just couldn't get to it and then finally got to one. So, but it's just one of those ones where you're like, well, there's two runs on the old ERA and you just got to wear it.
So does that kind of speak a little bit to anticipation? Like, so you and him have a history. He knows his scouting report. He knows he has that blue light line up there, and he knows that you like to go up there. So that he just anticipated that one perfectly.
Yeah,
right?
He's pumped. Yeah, he anticipated
finger
perfectly.
Guns to that kid. That's amazing.
It's amazing that the kind of things they could do when you anticipate. Does that mean he steps in the bucket early just to like clear
out?
Well,
you saw he just his hands. He brought him way in. It was in farther than even I had been throwing it. He just like, oh, that's far enough, I guess. And kind of one hand hit it. And he's just a big, big, strong dude. And he's just one, you know, he's probably one of five guys like Pete, maybe strong enough to do that. Judge.
Probably pulled it to one of the shorter parts of the park.
It's also like in the perfect line. Place. And it's in Arizona. Like there's not very many places that goes out. I think it's literally one of like three there in Houston, or not Houston, Tampa.
Yeah, but Max didn't appreciate that. It's one of three parks it would go out in.
Yeah, that exactly. I'm like, duh, that's, you know, we all go look that stuff up. But it's akin to excuses. You know, I know. I was like, I'm going to come around. Like, it's tip the cap, man. And we ended up winning the game. But, you know, we had a 3-run lead. And I gave up 2 runs. And you don't want to do that. It was the 8th inning. Like, early in the year, my arm wasn't feeling great. That was right before I got hurt. So, yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on. But, yeah, it's one of those things.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
So we've been wondering for a while on this show, you know, what could we do with public-facing information? Could we make good enough game plans to actually attack big league hitters in a way where we might get some results? And rather than start at the lower end of the player pool, we figured let's go to the top. Let's make this like a real challenge, right? Let's build a game plan to face Mookie Betts. The way we're going to do this, Eno's going to outline his plan first. Because this is stuff that anybody listening and watching can
scout
put together.
Nerd. I'm the nerd.
Yeah,
I've got my heat maps.
So clearly this,
Mr. May, I've got my heat maps.
This is going to work. So what would you do? You know, what would be your game plan? What are you going to tell your pitchers to do
against Mookie.
Well, you know, the first thing I want to pull up is like, I want to be like, well, we got to right on right. You know, we're going to throw him some sliders, right? So I look at the slider contact rate. Mookie Betts, I get, oh my God, what is this? What?
It's all red.
He's above 95% contact rate on like 90% of the zone. If you can hit like a penny off the bottom outside corner, you can get him to miss. That's the only place you can throw Mookie Betts a slider. So I'm like, okay, well, sliders are out. What are we going to do with the fastball? So I start looking at the fastball contact rate. And oh, look, he actually does swing and miss sometimes at high heaters. So, and it's not high third of the zone. Can't do that. It has to be along the black at the top of the zone. Might not be a great place to get a called strike, but it might be a place to punch him out. Okay, so I've found four seamers high might be a way to punch him out at the end, but I still got to get there. What else can I do? Is there, if I don't have a four seamer, or if I miss a little bit, or if he anticipates it, do we have a clip of what happens? Like, this is a pretty good fastball at the top of the zone. And dang.
Yeah, that's Ryan Helsley trying to execute that high fastball. Didn't work.
I'm looking right now at contact rates. If I look at, you know, if I look at home runs on contact or ISO, I might see, whoa, he can actually still hit those out. Or maybe I say, I don't really have a great four seam. I have a better sinker. So I click over to the sinkers. Ooh, now I've changed what I'm looking for. I'm looking for called strikes. Where can I get a called strike? Where does he not swing? And what you can see is he does not swing at backdoor sinkers. So if I think I can get a sinker to come back ball to strike sinker on the outside corner, then he won't swing at it. Well, guess what? That's a pretty hard pitch to negotiate. There are not a lot of guys who are good at that pitch. You know, it's kind of like could be a ball or could be a called strike, depending on how well you execute it. And if it gets over the middle of the plate, it's gone. So this is the deal. It's like we're looking to nibble. Like maybe if I have a good two-seamer, I can do a backdoor two-seamer, and then maybe I can throw the high four-seamer, you know, to strike him out. But the last thing, and this is not going to be on a heat map, is that if those are my two plans that I feel like, okay, these are some things I can do, then I have to do something other than that. I can't just keep trying to do these two things because he'll be like, oh, he's trying to hit me with a high four-seam. I'm going to hit a homer now. And so I have to do something that's just completely different, that's not on these maps. And so I guess my plan is the last thing I have here is his swing rates at curveballs. He knows that that's where they're supposed to be. So high, I have a chance of him not swinging at a high slider. So my plan is this. I bury some curveballs in the dirt or breaking balls in the dirt that are not there at all for any reason other than for him to think, oh, this guy's trying to slider me like everybody else, right? But I bury it. It's not like I want him, I just want him to think, oh, this guy's trying to do what everybody else is trying to do, throw sliders. I bury a slider in the ground, and then I try to get him with either a high slider or a high fastball. Once I get him thinking it's low, I'm throwing high fastballs and high sliders and playing off that and trying to actually get to called strike three. Because I don't think I'm going to get swinging strike three. I already showed you that heat map. So that's my plan. High fastballs and high sliders, which are, you know, not always easy to execute. I know, Mr. May, but try it. Try a high slider.
Yeah, Trevor, you get that game plan from Eno. How are you feeling about that game plan?
I'm not feeling like those are execute. Well, the high fastball I can do. But whether or not it's executable and what, like, if that's a place I want to go, I'm pretty well acquainted with where, when I throw something, if I hit a spot where it's at and when I miss a spot, and when my game plan is to miss spots, I'm not as confident in that, which then reduces the chances of me doing it. So it'd be tough. George Kirby, I think, could do this stuff. I think he's got that. He was a guy we mentioned. I think he's just crazy. He throws knuckleballs every once in a while. He's crazy enough to like, yeah, I'll go high breaking balls because I can throw it wherever I want. But that's rare. That kind of confidence in their command is rare. I'd say maybe Gallen would do this too, but you know, these guys are those are a couple of the best ones. So but for most guys, yeah, it's tough going against Mookie, but fortunately you definitely don't have Freddie Freeman followed by Ohtani after that, so
yeah, you survive, you find a way through, and then that's your reward. It's, oh, this is still very difficult to continue working through this Dodgers lineup. So what would you do? What would your plan be?
Fortunately, I have my scouting report here, and I know there's a lot on the screen, so real quick, what I would do, this is literally Mookie from 2023 through, yeah, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. So I look for a pitch that is open. And for me, if you can see it far on the left here, that is the changeup. And you can see miss rate towards the bottom and chase rate at the bottom. So chase rates, there's a lot of red down there, meaning he goes with you down below the zone with right-on-right changeups. Doesn't see him very often, but it is his weakest pitch in terms of action. When he hits it, it's not hit as hard. So I was like, oh, there's some changeup opportunity here. Unfortunately, though, there is some places he hit a mark because he hits every pitch hard. So the Nitro is right above that. Nitro is WOBA, by the way. It's expected WOBA. Just think of it as WOBA. And that's just total chances to produce a run.
Is that big red spot still changeups there?
In the middle?
Yeah, the two that are together,
the
top one.
The one that's the Nitro expected WOBA, the big one that has that
so
has
so I'm about it. To move on over to that. So on the left side, that is changeups overall. So the left column, we're going to go left to right like we're reading. So there's a spot for a miss overall, and that's down and in, which is exactly where I throw my changeup and want to throw it. Want to throw it for a strike, that's where he misses it. When I don't throw for a strike, it's below that, and he still has a chance to miss that. So I was like, that's there. That's there, possibly in every at bat. So then we move over. We go over one column. This is when I am ahead. So these are my opportunities when I am ahead. And this actually is changeups as well. So when I am ahead in the count, I have the advantage. It looks like he is even struggling and swinging and missing the most when you're ahead. So I'm like, okay, cool. It's a late pitch. It's a put away. I could use a changeup for a strikeout. Like I could use it. And that's big when it comes to Mookie because there's not a lot there. And there's some there that I like to see. Even the ones at the very bottom, you can see soft ground ball rate. There's three of the four he put in play down there. He also just rolled them over. So I'm like, great. Swing and miss or a possible ground ball.
Would you just be tempted to just go up there and throw him three straight
possibly too. And I also know, this is just from experience, I know he knows I know I have a good fastball and I throw a lot of them and then I'm going to at least give him one at some point. Which leads us to the middle, which is this is even and this is fastball. So like fastballs are used very, very commonly. 0-0, 1-1, you know, even 2-2. Like 2-2, fastball is a huge strikeout pitch because it's like, it's still kind of a breaking ball count and I can get, if I got good velo that day, I can get it by guys because I go for that. So I throw a lot of even fastballs. So I'm like, is that an option here? The answer to that question is nope.
No.
And if you see, if you can tell, he guards the inner, like the middle of the plate, like the edges, yeah, there's some blue, but they're not misses. Like they're probably foul balls or they're probably, you know, fouled off.
Takes, called strikes.
Takes or something, yeah. But like if it leaks either way towards the middle of the plate, he crushes it. And not only does he crushes it every time. And there's no miss. Like he has like one spot of miss, which might be one pitch in the zone. And then it's just blue. So like there's no miss and he crushes it. So I'll probably just not throw an even fastball. So let's put that out of our mind. So I'm like, cool. Even fastball, let's stick with a changeup and even counts. And then we move over one more time, and this last one is all three pitches. So from left to right, fastball, slider, changeup. I understand that I could have put some titles at the top. That'll help. Next time we'll do that. But this is all the pitches, and this is when you're behind. So I go, okay, what am I going to do even? What am I going to do when I'm ahead? And then at the end, because I don't ever anticipate being behind, I look at behind. So here's behind. What is open for misses when I'm behind? What can I fool him with? Look, nothing's really sliders. No, he doesn't miss sliders when he's behind. When he's ahead, he doesn't miss fastballs when he's ahead. But he does miss changeups. So I'm like, I'm probably going to throw all changeups when I am either ahead and I'm even. And then when I'm behind, I'm probably still going to throw changeups. So it's going to be fastball changeup him. I'm not going to throw a slider because there's just no reason to.
When you look at all this, when do you like? Do you have a plan for the fastball? You're like, when's the fastball?
So like you said, I would have noticed fastball up top is always. I'm never going to be like fastball down ever because it's just something that has never worked for me ever. It's something I'm not confident in. It's very rare and it's usually an accident when I get a freeze. So I always think fastballs up. Are they open? You mentioned earlier he takes them early in the count if he can hit the top of the zone. So I would take shots up there hoping for a take. Or a foul off early in the count to get ahead. So I might go fastball. Soon as I'm ahead, though, it's going to be changeup party after that. And then see if he adjusts. If he comes out of his shoes and swings and misses at one, I know he's going to be, all right, I don't want to do that again. If he takes one in the zone, I'm good still. He doesn't know.
But if you see him sort of slowing down his hands and looking at you like,
or
oh,
I throw
like,
a really
oh,
good one just
doing.
Below and he takes it.
Then you got to go back to the high fastball or just
probably
try
go back to
totally
high fastball,
different.
Probably in. Or if I have a really good slider, like if I'm like, I got really good command of the slider, which was rare. I'll be honest. The changeup always felt better.
Try to hit that penny off the outside corner.
And then you, yeah, take a shot. You take one shot and just miss off. But this would have to be in like an 0-2, 1-2 situation. And that's usually the time he's taking. So you want to try to graze the edge down there. But honestly, the best case scenario, you throw an 0-2 slider just off the plate and he like hits it a second. You're like, did it. We got Mookie out. So going for swings and misses was tough. But fortunately, I did strike him out half the times to face him. So no big deal. 3-2 changeup. Don't worry about the stolen base. He stayed there. He stayed there. It was fine. It worked out.
What strikes me about this conversation, though, is that you have to look for things other than swinging strikes. Like you have to look for maybe an end zone take or a foul or weak contact. And so, you know, we have this like predisposition to like maybe do we believe weak contact exists in a way that like pitchers can really take advantage of that, because we've been optimizing for whiffs for so long that my instinct is always to sort these things for contact rate and be like, okay. But then when you got Mookie, you're like, well, crap, he makes contact everywhere. I gotta do something. So it's weak contact or intake, end zone takes is like what you're kind of looking for.
Yes. Yes. And like, and Freddie Freeman too, he's the same way. And he doesn't take in the zone. So it's like, he's harder in different ways. But yeah, when you're a reliever and your game, for my game, was always strikeouts, because that's the zero value for a hitter. Like that's the maximum value as a pitcher, just in getting three outs. I understand starters are different, but for me, that's what I was hunting. I'd start there. Is there a miss? When there was no miss, then it went to what is the lowest risk of damage of like this person then beating me, because I can't let them beat me. So it's like, I want to dominate them, but if I can't, then I just really need them to not beat me. And that's how you go through your checks. Now, that's why the team like the Dodgers is so good, because they have like 4, 5, and then at any given day, there could be a guy at the back of the lineup that is this guy. They all have the opportunity to do that. The guy that beats you, when you have 3 guys, 4 guys that you need to not beat you in a 9-person lineup, it's a very hard team to, you got to get lucky. There's got to be some luck involved, and there's got to be, you know, you just got to be really, really prepared. So it's a great example. Mookie's a great example because he's got the other guys that you also have to prepare the same way for in front of and behind him.
It just sounds like the biggest difference between an elite hitter and a good or even an average hitter, of course, just be their ability to anticipate what you want to do to them. All of your game planning, they've deconstructed that. They have a plan for your plan. And that's why your plan becomes so much less effective. Also seems like the gap. I mean, as a reliever, it's hard enough. As a starter, you may have to face him 3 times. So you may get him once, but he's going to adjust what you did the first time, and you got to go out there and try to get him 2 more times. That seems borderline
like
impossible.
If he spots your changeup plan, he's like, next time up, he's like, this guy's going to throw me a changeup.
Yeah, well, then it might be I'm going sliders just because I'm kind of throwing that out, and it's going off of experience, especially if it's later in that series. I'm facing him again, 4-game series. Then
now
I might
give him
2 sliders
in a row.
Now you're
going to try to play off the fact that he's thinking that you're going to do that.
So if I throw 2 sliders, throw him for a strike, and he's like, first pitch, in a situation where it's like 1 out and there's nobody on, or 1 guy on first, and he's trying to work the count, and I throw a slider first pitch for a strike, he's like, dang it. Like that, now I might be a little bit ahead of him. I'm just trying to get through the series, staying ahead of him. And the next time we'll worry about how it changed next time, but this time, and that's very much your life as a reliever.
One of the things that also sticks out for me in this situation is that unlike many relievers, you had 3 pitches. So you had at least 3 ideas that you could go to in this situation. And that's really important as we look through it. And we're like, what do you do, you know, if that right on right changeup doesn't work, or if he looks too comfortable against it, you know? And so what we did, we just looked up real quick, like who are the best hitters, you know, in the last 2 years against relievers, and lo and behold, Mookie's number one, you know? And I think that there's something about that. He's such a good anticipator. I think we've denigrated in the public sphere this idea of guess hitting. There's like, that's something that people say about like an older, oh, he's just guessing now or whatever. But from what I've seen in the research, pre-release information is super important. What that says to me is sort of educated guessing. It's like, I know the scouting report, and now I'm seeing something in his delivery or something that like before the release that tells me, oh, this is the changeup that I'm anticipating, and now I am ready. I'm into changeup swing, you know. It's very complicated process hitting. It's very reactive, but it's reactive. It's not just reactive like you stand up there and you have no idea what's happening.
Yeah, that's a pure guess. Like guessing in the traditional sense is like I'm going off of nothing. But then there's you're narrowing down the possibilities, and then you're multiple choice guessing.
Right, and you're just hoping to have like a sort of a 50-50 spot where you get them to a 50-50 spot. And you're like, if it's high, it's either this or this. And if I put my good swing on it, it's a homer or a miss or whatever. Like that's why the misses go up too, because the velo is high. So it's like you could say, all right, if it's high, it's probably a fastball. And I'm going to put my A swing on this 98 mile an hour fastball. And oh, he just threw me a high slider. Crap.
And the truly great guys, like the Josh Haders and the Felix Bautistas of the world, you can be like, oh, the fastball's up. I know that, blah, blah. And it doesn't matter. Like you made the right guess and you still missed it.
You sort of had that with the Christian Walker.
Exactly. That's when you start to question.
You
like
did the right thing.
It goes down. The questioning of your game goes down into your soul. You're like, am I just bad? Like that happens. They just get you even though there's no way they should have gotten you there.
They weren't supposed to.
But that just like that happened to me about one. There was one time a year basically where something happened where I'm like, he never done it up to that point. He probably will never do it again. Like it's just it was just my turn.
But it still rattles you.
It still rattles you, though, because you want to be able to fix. Like, I wanted to be able to fix everything. I wanted everything to be an equation that I could solve, and that's just not the way it is. And that was something I battled with my whole career and will continue to battle with probably for my whole life. So,
my brain also works that way. It can be rough.
I wonder how you use this to evaluate hitters. Like, how do you see that in a hitter? How do you see that? Like, do you think you could face a kid in the minors and be like, oh, like this guy, like what would they do that you would be like, oh, this guy really has an elite sort of anticipation?
Oh, like you knew immediately with Soto. You knew, honestly, Jackson Holliday does. He has it. I think that's what they call it. Like they're like elite plate discipline or elite feel or elite vision at the plate. Like that's like they have a good plan, but their ability to make that adjustment or be wrong with that guess and still continue the AB. Like that's the good hitter to elite. Like that's when you see it, you're like, this kid could be. That's a level that not everyone can do that.
Have you ever faced Soler?
Yes.
What's interesting to me is like I think he has a really good sense of the zone. Like yeah, he knows what the zone is.
He does, and that's gotten better and better and better over the years.
But I don't know that he has a great sense of spin, but I don't know how great anybody sees spin. So I don't know if you remember these at bats. Sometimes pitchers are just like Rolodexes, but like, so the book had, for him in a long time, I think, has been breaking balls in the zone because it looks like it's in the zone and he's kind of like, oh, in the zone, a swing, you know, swings over it. Is that something that you remember from Soler? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's an all a swing all the time guy. There's a few of these guys like Duvall's an a swing all the time guy. Renfro is a swing all the time guy. CJ Cron. Like they're guys who are okay taking really bad swings sometimes, being wrong, but having
just get another chance.
But having a really good idea of the zone. Like that's how they adjust it. They're like, in order to do this though, I just got to make sure I'm swinging at pitches that actually can be hit and just don't be wrong as much. But like, it's okay to have my one zone that I crush and have a hole somewhere and just make them have to pepper that one place over and over again. And then I'll just be out, I guess. Because I just can't, like for whatever reason, how I swing, just my skill set does not line up to hit that pitch. But if they miss, I'm going to take advantage of it. And that's why those guys have made careers. So Lair's like a really good version of that. Like he's gotten really good at working the counts. And he's scary and he's big and he hits home runs. So he's going to get his walks too. That's how he gets walked. It's not just straight plate discipline. It comes down to like he builds an intimidation and just doesn't swing as much out of the zone as you would think he would. And that's what made him the player he is now. So those guys, but that's, he knows, he's like, I need to get my A swing off and I need to make sure I do. And all those guys do it.
Sliders in the zone could be scary to people who don't feel like their breaking balls are elite. Like if your breaking ball isn't elite, then you train yourself on basically get it low and away. If it's not elite by stuff, you're like, at least it has to be in that spot that makes it playable. Right. And so I guess maybe people don't train a lot to throw sliders a little bit higher where that would need to be to kind of fool Soler. And then I bet you if I do a search run at right now for Soler and homers on breaking balls in the zone, he probably has some because every once in a while he can be like, okay, I got it. I know the book on me. I know you're going to fill it up with sliders. So this time I'm going to anticipate it. And I'm going to hit like, you know, 5 homers in 2 weeks off of sliders in the zone. And everyone's going to be like, crap, we got to come up with some new idea.
Then he's going to get his other stuff back. And that's when
then I'm going to go back to my fastball swing, right? Or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. You just scare them into thinking that it's a pitch you can't throw. But you can. It's just they made a slight adjustment. Or they just got some bad ones for, like, Soler hits the ones that stay kind of inner third, like back up a little bit. He crushes those. Like, he catches those. Those are big mistakes, but a lot of guys struggle with those because they're going out there with you and then they can't adjust. He's just like, his swing path doesn't really.
He can clear that.
He can clear it, yeah. And he's so strong. He can get jammed. He's like Walker. He can get jammed and hit it out. And he knows that. So he'll hit that, but like you said, like guys will try it a couple times. He'll run into some not so good ones, hit three or four homers in a series or something, and then everyone's terrified of sliders. But if you go look, you're like,
these and then they'll fall behind and feel they have to throw the fastball. And he's like, that.
You're like, none of these were good sliders, guys.
This is what I wanted all along.
The hole's still there, right? The hole's still there, even if his slugging went way up and the ISO went whatever. The hole is still there. It's just maybe a little bit smaller. You can still go there. Don't be afraid. But that gets lost in translation sometimes. It does. Sometimes you don't have time to like show that story. So you're just like, here's what he did. And you're like, oh no, like that's really common. It's just, there's a lot of information.
The interesting thing too on Henry Davis, when I looked at the high and away hole that he had, he had like a 600 slugging or something on those pitches. It's because he put like two balls in play and one was a homer.
Exactly.
So like, you have to be careful sometimes also when you're sorting these things, when you're sorting these heat maps. Like, there's some heat maps you have the option of doing raw, like raw numbers, so you can actually see how many pitches are in each one. Because if you do the heat map and it smooths it over, like, ooh, red, that's bad, right?
Yeah, it's just nine. But if you then
click over to the raw, you're like, oh, that's, he hit two pitches out and he whiffed five times and he hit 26 fouls. It's like, maybe that's still a good place, even though the red heat map sort of made me think that it wasn't.
That's why I always liked WOBA, because it factored in walks too. Like, so there was red also where they take. Like, take and those at-bats produced him going to first. And so... so you're like, ooh, there's a bunch of red over here. He's like, he just doesn't swing up like at all. Like, it basically reinforced it. So I got double the information a little bit. Though when I showed it to other guys, they were like, why is all there's so much red outside the zone? I'm like, those aren't put in play. How do I explain this? It's more of an encompassing stat though. So I did always appreciate, like, in general, it's like, if you just go to the miss and away from any of this red and those things overlap, then that's zero value. That's how you get that person to create zero value.
There was a point a few years ago I was looking at trying to rank hitters, and I decided to combine pop-ups, infield fly balls with strikeouts, because I felt like there might have been some hitters that weren't striking out, but they were just giving us terrible plate appearances or getting a bad outcome.
B-swings.
Yeah, getting a B-swing, and it's like, okay, well, we think this guy's really good because his K rate's low, but he's not quite as good as we think because he actually pops the ball up a little bit more than a typical player. So this question kind of drives at that from Saul. It says, Trevor was in the 99th percentile in pop-up percentage in 2023 among pitchers with at least 100 batted ball events against. What kind of hitters are prone to produce pop-ups? Is it hitters with high bat speed, or is it something else?
Ooh, that's really interesting. I mean, obviously bat angle, your natural bat angle. A lot of guys are low ball hitters. Low ball hitters generally scoop. When they make a mistake, they go too low. More than too high a lot of times. And when that's the case, and maybe your stuff doesn't have as much depth, I was throwing a lot of sweepers that were more side to side. Like, it was another pitch that kind of seeing, they wanted to see up more. And so they added that to my fastball. So guys were like overthinking how far it was going to drop. It was a breaking ball that wasn't having as much depth as they anticipated because my slider had more. So it's like,
so you swing under it.
So they were swinging under it a lot. And I've always been that. And then I also throw up a lot. Like, even changeups would go up. And so, like, you throw a high changeup and it kind of stays flat and it kind of floats in there. If they see fastball for a split second, it's going to get missed or it's going to get popped up. And that happened quite a bit too. So I threw up fastball so much that the eye level was there that getting the depth off of that was really, really hard to do. And then the guys who threw like me also tended to get lots of pops up. Strider, lots of fly balls, tons and tons of fly balls.
It's like a ride thing, right?
It's a ride thing too. So like, ride just generally is when you're trying to get the miss, they're going to swing under it. So sometimes when the ride's not quite there, or they're trying to go with you and they guess right, they still might be on it. They're just still lower, still a little bit lower than they know it's going to be. And that produces a pop-up. But I was getting a lot of pop-ups in the infield, and a lot of them were change-ups because guys just dive out. They're a lower hitter. They're a low ball hitter. And to make that adjustment, you got to try to keep the hands back, which then usually lowers the barrel. So it's like, you're like, and you just try to flick it. And when you try to flick the ball, that's when you pop it up in the infield. And then I had all of that foul territory too. Oakland's probably going to have a bunch of guys in that sometimes, like anyone with ride in Oakland is going to have a bunch of pop-up extra too, because, well, not anymore after this year, but just because of the, those are called foul outs or pop-ups, and they're all factored into fly, like the ability to hit the ball in the air.
Still the biggest foul territory in the league, isn't it? The Coliseum, by far?
By far.
One thing that's a little bit weird is if you just look at infield fly balls on Fangraphs, you'll see it's like right away, you'll see it's correlated with fly ball rate. So you're at the very top is Isak Paredes, Dalton Varsho, Anthony Santander, you know, Kyle Schwarber. These are all guys that are low ball hitters that, I think this is the scooping infield fly ball. They hit a lot of fly balls, and so sometimes their distribution of fly balls includes the ones that are bad. You know, if you're hitting the ball like 25 degrees a lot, 30 degrees, you're going to hit some that are 40 and 45, and those are pop-ups. So that's part of it. I think that what's hard about pop-ups is there's another class of player that does hit pop-ups from different kinds of mishits. So Hunter Renfro is up there. Carlos Santana, Keibert Ruiz, Jake Berger, Elias Diaz, Jurickson Profar. I don't know. These are guys that have sub 40% fly ball rates, but still have these big pop-up rates. And I was thinking about, like, people don't really do this, but let's say you swing down the ball and you were kind of like chopping at wood. You can still do an infield fly ball pretty quickly because if the ball's coming in and you just sort of chop at it. Like there's a scoop infield fly ball where you're almost hitting it down, and it's going chipping, too far up.
Chipping
but ball. Then there's also the like, I'm hitting it. I'm trying to go straight and this ball's coming like this and I just chop it. You know, there are different ways that foul balls are created. And like whether or not there's a skill is something I tried to look at. And somebody like a lot of these bad ball hitters that have bad that reach a lot, chase a lot, end up the only way you can make it to the big leagues and chase a ton is by making a lot of contact outside the zone at first, but also sometimes fouling balls off. So Pablo Sandoval always fouled balls off. He's a spoiler. And I do think on some level, spoiling is a skill. And I bet you that guys that chase a lot and maybe hit pop-ups are spoilers. And they'll just kind of, they'll mishit these balls, but they'll make just enough contact to stay alive. And it's almost like this Henry Davis foul ball thing. So not all pop-ups are created equal. So that makes it, pop-ups are a really interesting thing to try and study. I've tried to study a couple of times. They're not obvious.
They're super noisy, right? I mean, they're all over the place from
except on the pitching side. On the pitching side, reliably, we put pop-ups into FIP. So we thought it was reliable enough. It was something that pitchers could do often enough. And the batting average was low enough on pop-ups that like we could include that in FIP.
That's why my FIP was always way lower than my ERA, except for the last year, pretty much every year, because I got lots of pop-ups.
That's part of it. But on the hitting side, it's a little bit harder to nail down exactly what creates pop-ups. I would just say it's mishitting. And it's not always a terrible mishit. It could be something they could iron out fairly quickly. That's why I think there's noise. You know, they could be popping it up for a little bit and then be like, oh, I'm just swinging too far under the ball, or I'm chopping at wood too much, or I'm swinging at the wrong pitches or whatever. So I think that is something that hitters can kind of iron out a little bit. It's too small of a sliver to kind of focus on for the hitter.
Thanks for that question, Saul. Todd Brown has a question. Hunter Brown, broken, injured, or just a blip? Obviously a rough day against the Royals yesterday. That was 9 runs on 11 hits in 2/3 of an inning. We've talked about it, piling all of that badness onto your ratios early in the year and how long it takes to fix that. Is there something actually wrong with Hunter Brown, or was it just a really bad day against the Royals?
It was a really bad day. He doesn't look sharp. I mean, he was just feeding that curveball in, and it was just getting just pummeled, and he didn't make the adjustment, but it was not sharp. He was throwing it in the zone. It was very loopy. Like, you know, it was like 80, 81, and he usually throws it like 84. So like it didn't have the sharpness. It's a major weapon that he has. You know, he had some velo, but he wasn't like throwing the hardest he's ever thrown. And Kauffman's kind of not great for ride. The numbers are always down a little bit there just with the humidity. I mean, I know it's a little bit cooler, but it doesn't ride quite as good as other places. So yeah, it just looked like a lot of stuff in the middle of the zone and then some unluckiness. And the Royals are kind of hot. So I think it was a perfect storm. But yeah, that's a record for most hits without throwing in an inning. That's what we call a season killer. It's something he's going to look up and be like, well, I wish I could just erase that one. Like at the end of the year, they're going to be like, you know, Hunter Brown had a 4-1. But if you take this outing out, You know, he has a 3-2. I think I still
believe in him. Like, when you watch him, you're like, there's still pretty good stuff here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't look sharp. Like, and he's young. And they're off to a slow start, too. So, like, you got to remember, there's, like, some pressure. I got to be sharp now. I'm not sharp. I'm going to get frustrated. It just makes it worse. You know, he's not even, like, I doubt he feels, like, super comfortable and, like, oh, I have a spot forever. Like, you know what I mean? Like, especially with, like, how Blanco came up. Life. Yeah, and just did what he did. And put some pressure on it, like if someone comes back.
Somebody's going down when Verlander's back.
Exactly.
Right.
And I've had that exact situation happen, and there's a lot when you're young. You know, I was worried about Irvin Santana coming back, taking my job. But I got moved to the bullpen, and then we saw how that worked out. So I blessing this guy. But so there's a lot of that, probably. I don't think he's broken.
He has Atlanta. Yeah,
it's a hold and bench. I think when someone is looking hold like and this bench. And the stuff is not crisp, this is what a bench is made for. There's ceiling, there's talent. Don't use him in a matchup that tough. You probably wouldn't have used him against Atlanta anyway, even if the blow-up hadn't happened yesterday. Because Hunter Brown isn't on that level.
But you probably did use
yet.
Him against the Royals.
You definitely used him against the Royals, and you felt good about it. So that's why the gut punch is even worse.
I mean, if it's a keeper league, I'm holding on to a guy who's a 92-mile-an-hour slider in a keeper league. You know, like, he has three breaking balls that are pretty good. The four-seam fastball, not as good this year, but it's still an okay pitch. And I think that all together, it still has a lot of upside, and he's still a guy who's had long strands of success. So in keeper leagues, I'm keeping him 15 plus. I'm keeping him on my bench. You know, 12s and 10s, you just gotta keep moving. You know, there's gonna be somebody else out there that you're gonna be excited about too. So you can move on, I guess.
Jimmy offered up a way to pitch to Mookie Betts. Just plunk the mascot to start the mound appearance so Mookie doesn't dig in. I mean, there is one Mookie hack. I've got this. Bailey Ober found a hack. Look at this. Look where Bailey Ober pitches him. Oh, hey, you get a called strike out there, no problem.
Oh, and he got ripped too.
Yeah.
That's the worst. You get rippered, like, just on a pitch 6 inches outside. That's tough.
Did you have a favorite umpire for how he'd punch guys out when you struck him out? It's him. It's Ripper.
But my guy, my favorite guy, I've talked about this a little bit. My favorite guy just overall now is just Ben May. No relation.
No relation, yeah.
But he was always really good. Like, I don't know what there was, but he actually was behind the plate for 5 of my appearances last year, and I had a 0. So thank you, Ben. Hopefully it was...
But just like you liked his hot and cold mess, like you liked where he called strikes.
Just a good dude, you know. Just a good dude, great name. And every time I would walk out to the bullpen, and if he was on the bases, I just make sure he was gonna.
Just felt good.
I'd see him at the Evergreen. Yeah, you gonna see it Thanksgiving? All right, see you later, man. So
the no relation thing. I was thinking about that with Todd Brown. I'm like, is that Hunter's uncle asking if he should drop his nephew? Is that what's happening here? There is some of that because Alex Bregman's uncle is a fantasy baseball player, Larry Schechter. He's played in Tout Wars and NFBC and Labor and stuff. And it's just kind of weird. I saw them have an exchange on Twitter and Alex called him Uncle Larry. And I was like, does Alex just have a really odd sense of humor? And they're like, no, they're actually related. So... Hey, you never know. Sometimes you get the family advice. It's hard. It'd be hard to drop a family member in a fantasy league. It'd be very hard to do that. You wouldn't want to talk about that Thanksgiving.
My son is reading my pieces, and at the end of them, I'm like, did you like it? He's like, every time, he's like, yeah. Did you really, though? But one thing I've seen from Little League, I like demonstrative calls because if you're actually scoring the game or if you're the game changer dad, like, and you can't tell whether it was a ball or a strike, like, you want to know if it's a ball or a strike, you know? So a nice demonstrative strike call, you're like, oh, that was a strike. I can put that in my book.
Yeah, but
I don't have to wait for
it doesn't have to be like Soda Popinski punching someone out there. Like, the full spin, yeah. Or like a finishing move, like Street Fighter finishing move. Like, you don't need that when it's children. Like, that's one step too far, but I could understand. Yeah, wanting a clear call would be helpful.
Yeah, that would be a little over the top.
If it's being blogged about.
There's enough crying in Little League Baseball. If you had some of that, they'd be even more crying.
One last question here. This is from Schaefer on the stream. Who's the most underrated second baseman? I threw this out there because I have not thought about this question in a while. Underrated second baseman. I mean, Ketel Marte, from a what he does as a hitter perspective, still feels a little underrated in the broader sense. Defensively,
nobody trusts him. I couldn't shop him for the life of me in my dynasty leagues, and here he is playing well again. I would have said before the season, Gleyber Torres, he's kind of fighting through it right now, But I still see a guy who makes above average contact, above average patience, above average power, above average speed, kind of above average across the board. That would be kind of my answer, I think.
Maybe Polanco. I know he's not started strong, but I think in 162 games, he'll be a guy that's probably not talked about a lot, but will contribute a lot. I like the Marte call too. Like he's a guy you like, because you hear about all the young lefty sticks that all are so fast there, and then you're like, they have Marte. You guys remember this guy? He's batting third. Like, like he kind of gets lost in the shuffle, which is weird because he's like a really, really, he's a freak athlete too. Like he's an impressive player. When he's hot, he's impossible to get out. So I would say, yeah, maybe he's not talked about enough either.
Live Hive's buzzing. Bryce Terang getting a couple from my burner accounts, apparently. I mean, I don't think so. I think Terang is a really good defensive player. I'm still not sure he's ever going to hit the ball hard enough to be an above average hitter in the big leagues. Controls the zone pretty well. At least he did as a prospect, but I don't know. I'm not seeing the long-term ceiling there. Andrés Giménez getting some love in here as well. Phillips, hot take here, maybe Semien? I mean, it's the idea of Semien just being thought of as well above average, but not being thought of as elite, and maybe because of what he's done over the last 3-4 seasons now, maybe he has actually joined that group.
Yeah, maybe we should start talking about him as elite. He is kind of mentioned in the MVP race quite a bit. Had a pretty good year last year. I know he's got Seager, but like, it's a pretty good year. So yeah, maybe he should be in that conversation a little more. It's weird. It's all these guys who are like maybe the second best hitter on their team, but you're like, but what about that guy? Like the shortstop's better, but like it's, you know, second base is, it's a premium position. If you can play defense is a big thing, but if you can hit, I mean, you're going to be, you know, better than probably 20 teams have, right?
Yeah. And if you get back to the 2022 levels for Andrés Giménez, like if that's closer to his baseline, then he's underrated. I think it's more of a question than a certainty at this point.
I think it's an interesting question because I think the whole position is underrated, actually, because second base, you don't have second base prospects really in the minor leagues. It's, you know, second base is where you stick that guy. You're like the third baseman who has a little bit enough range to handle it, yeah. Or the shortstop who doesn't have the arm, or, you know, like if I look up Baseball America's, you know, top 100, like, will there be one second baseman in their top 100? Like, it's just not a position that we hype. And so you could actually make the case that Jose Altuve is. I know he's going to the Hall of Fame and like he's a Hall of Fame guy, but like he wasn't thought of as a big prospect coming up. So he was underrated at some point in his career, you know. Semien is a guy who like doesn't maybe have the per at bat eliteness that you have when you put him up per at bat against the other guys, but he's like elite at staying on the field and he's above average in so many things that you're like, oh, when you do that for 650, 700 plate appearances every year, then it is actually elite. I remember when like I voted for Bobby Abreu for the Hall of Fame, and there was a lot of people who didn't like that. It was a similar kind of a case to Marcus Semien, where it's just like he posted. He was really, really good, and he posted, and he was there all the time, and he was good enough at a bunch of different skills that it added up. But you never thought of him at, he never won an MVP. He never even got in the top three. He never thought of him as the best at his position. I think Semien will have a similar case, actually. When the Hall of Fame comes around, people will say, oh, but he never won MVP, or he never did this, or, you know, he was never the best, one of the best five players in the league. And you'd be like, yeah, but he was, for like 10 years, he was like the 12th best player in the league.
Yeah, if he puts 4 or 5 more seasons together, that's the kind of conversation we'll have at the end of his career. It's still has to do a lot to
still
get there.
Still too early. The aging curves matter right now for him.
Durability is huge.
It's
though.
The position of undervalued players. So underrated, undervalued players. So picking one is kind of like, you can make the case for Bryson Stott. You can make a case for a lot of these second basemen, Tyro Estrada. Like they're often forgotten players that, you know, you just sort of find a second baseman. You just, you know, you kind of figure it out. It's like a right fielder or something where you're just like, we'll put a guy who didn't work out at first base out there or something, you know? I guess it's more left field. Left field is right field. You want them to actually have an arm. Left field is where you sort of like stick a guy.
Well, we have to go. So thank you. Thank you to the Live Hive for chiming in and joining us at 1 o'clock Eastern. We're here each and every Friday. You can find us on Twitter. Trevor is at I am Trevor May. Eno is at Eno Saris. I'm at Derek Van Riper. The pod is at Rates and Barrels. You can join our Discord with the link in the show description. Hit us up, ratesandbarrels@gmail.com. If you like emails, we'll answer those as well. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to like this video on YouTube. Have a great weekend. We are back with you on Monday.